When Angela Garbus became pregnant, she, like so many women, read the recommended pregnancy guidebooks. While she was seeking information, what she found was instruction and prescription laden with condensation and judgment. Although she was becoming a mother for a first time, she knew something was amiss. So Ms. Garbus, a journalist, started to research breast milk and wrote an article that went viral entitled, "The More I Learn About Breast Milk, The More Amazed I Am." Now she's challenging common ideas around pregnancy and motherhood in her new book, Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through Science and Culture of Pregnancy, published by Harper Wave. Angela, welcome to the show.
Hi, DW. Thanks for having me.
So pregnancy, it seems to be a particularly, noisy time for women. You write, too many strangers have too many unsolicited opinions about this thing.
That's actually something that a woman said to me when we were waiting in line for coffee at a coffee
shop.
Which, by the way, you know, maybe you shouldn't have too much coffee.
Exactly. There you go. Well, there's an example. Yeah. That's a fantastic example. So why are people so apt to divulge, you know, information or stories or anecdotes or advice about being pregnant?
Well, I think it's a really universal experience, right? Everyone was born. Everyone has a mother. Someone got pregnant and gave birth to you. So in many ways, we all feel, I don't know, I think people feel some sort of ownership over pregnant women. And where maybe it starts off as the best of intentions, wanting to connect with someone, it sort of veers off into condescension, mm-hmm. and you become really a screen for people to project their opinions, which are not always founded in
right.
any real information. It's just something they heard
right.
or something they happened to think.
Right. Yeah. Do you think that pregnancy makes people, in general terms, uncomfortable? Because it's a very powerful time in a woman's life and people are uncomfortable with having women having power.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, being able to grow a whole person out of nothing inside your body and then birth it is a tremendous power. I would say it's like a superpower. And of course, it's hugely intimidating, I think.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. I mean, I think the need to control women because mm-hmm. we rely on women. I think that's where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, you know, a pregnant woman is bursting with life. And I think that people, you know, we're a generally pretty disembodied culture. And I think it makes people uncomfortable in that mm-hmm. way to have to confront a body and to think about that you have one and that you came out of someone's vagina. That
right.
makes people freak out.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely it does. When you were newly pregnant, like most pregnant women, you had a plethora of questions. Who did you originally direct those questions toward? Where were some of the first places you went?
Some of the first places I went were books, you know, the classic books like What to Expect When You're Expecting. I had a lot of friends recommend the Sears Healthy Baby and Healthy Pregnancy books. So that's where it started, also because I'm someone who's a writer and I read a lot. So I went to books first because also, I mean, you have prenatal appointments, but they're really every few weeks. And usually it's about a half an hour. And I should say I have wonderful healthcare. I love my doctor, but you're not always able to go into things in the way that you want.
Right.
So it started with What to Expect and books like that. And I mean, those books are valuable. They have information. There's a reason why people keep going to them. But a lot of times what I realized was I felt like I had to suspend my critical mind as I was reading these books because they're saying, do this, don't do that. We tend to just view everything about pregnancy and the advice as there's a right way and a wrong way, which leads people to feel like if I don't do it this way, then I'm doing it badly and I'm a bad mom. And as I was reading, I just felt like this framework does not work for me. You know, what if we just gave people information?
Yeah.
Because we're all really just doing the best we can.
In those books, how are good moms and bad moms, quote unquote, defined?
So, I mean, in the Sears books, they're very big into something called attachment parenting. That's basically like never put your baby down.
Right.
Your baby needs you to the point that, you know, like, what I realized was not many people can afford to do that. People go, 25% of women in America go back to work after 2 weeks. You know, that's not a lot
Bonkers.
Of time. You can't afford to hold your baby all the time. So things like that, you know, I was reading this book and I understand there are benefits. Healthy attachment is great. But, you know, if a baby's loved, you're going to find a way to make that baby feel loved. And the idea that you could feel badly about yourself because you want to go to work or you don't have a choice to not go back to work, those were things that didn't sit well with me, and that was a lot of the driving force behind the book.
Well, and so piggybacking on that, tell us about how ways that society and perhaps the medical community play on a new mom's fears.
Well, I mean, I think you, like, you know, it was only really in the last century that we moved birth out of homes and out of the care of midwives who were, you know, now we have, there's usually nurse midwives who have medical training, but, you know, people have been having babies for
quite some time now.
Hundreds of thousands of years, right? And we've, and, you know, we have, medicine has been great because the maternal mortality rate has gone down and so has the infant mortality rate. But we've sort of started to treat it as a condition, right? Or almost like an illness in a way. Whereas before we used to see it as just a natural part of life and you could treat those things. And I think that, you know, from in my own experience, I had a previous C-section. I mean, my baby's out there. She's almost 3 months old and she's hanging out in the green room with my husband. But I was basically told, well, you're 40, which is a geriatric pregnancy.
Right.
And they were like, you really should schedule a C-section for your exact due date because, well, because you're so old, the baby might die.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, there's no, is there room for a discussion about this? You know,
yeah.
Like it was, I felt like that was being pushed on me.
And no greater fear could they push on you.
Oh, no, exactly. And I, who at the time I was like, I literally wrote a book about this and it shut me up really quickly.
Yeah.
And I felt like we do this to women all the time where it's really hard. I'm really good at advocating for myself, but not everyone is like that. And if that's what the average interaction with a doctor is, where we look at doctors as having expertise,
yeah,
you know, right? They have training and there's a lot of stuff that they know. That's true. But, you know, again, women have been birthing things. And when it comes to your own body and your own lived experience, you are also an expert. And so there could be more of a dialogue between the medical establishment and its patients.
Yeah, well, and it seems like this this shift in terms of how women give birth, moving into hospitals with doctors, predominantly surgeons, really mm-hmm. sort of changed the way birthing happened, right? I mean, some of it to accommodate the doctors themselves. In fact, even how the woman is traditionally in the 20th century physically placed to give birth, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. So, I mean, that's actually the traditional position that you see, you know, women on their backs with their feet in stirrups, right? That's what you always see in movies and TV.
Right.
Like, that's what I grew up thinking. Well, that's how you give birth. You lay down. And but meanwhile, like pushing a baby out when you're in that position is like trying basically to push a baby uphill, like
cutting
out of
gravity off at the pass.
Yeah. Whereas before, you know, people really would be were squatting, they're pulling on ropes and branches. Like it was much more active.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is really just to, it's convenient and it fits into schedules more, and that's the way doctors prefer to have you in that way.
Right. Yeah. But there's a lot of pushback on that now, right? Or a lot of I know midwifery is sort of, I feel like it's had a renaissance in the last a few decades, and there are more medical centers and professionals sort of working with women to give them, to alert them to these possibilities and other ways of giving birth.
And I think it's, you know, I don't want it to be a contentious, antagonistic relationship where one is right and one is wrong. I mean, that's exactly the trap that I was talking about earlier that I think we should avoid. I think, what if we, at this point, we have multiple ways of giving birth. Some people really want to have surgery, really want pain medication, and that's great that it's available for them. But what about if we just make the focus on mothers and patients and what they want and making sure that whatever option is out there is the safest and is most accessible to them? That's it's pretty basic. And it's sort of sad that the argument has to be made for that.
No, it's a great example of an act of nature that we've in some cases complicated. I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Angela Garbus about her book, Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy, published by Harper Wave. You had a doula, yes?
I did.
What inspired that?
Well, when I heard about what a doula was, which is someone who exists, excuse me, just for you, just for me, and supporting me, who doesn't have a medical role and is just there to, you know, rub my back if I want, bring me snacks if I want, like help my husband if he's freaking out a little bit because it's overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, why wouldn't I have that? Why mm-hmm. wouldn't I want that? You know, like nurses provide wonderful care for you, but they work for somebody else. And mm-hmm. the idea that someone could be there for me, I think every woman should have that right.
Mm-hmm. There was some legislation moving through the State House in Oklahoma regarding pregnancy, abortion rights, and a male elected official in 2016 said, "I understand that they feel like it is their body. I feel like it is separate. What I call them is you are a host." You write that pregnancy is political. Has it always been this way? If not, when and how did this happen?
I mean, I would say probably yes, as long as we've been trying to control women. It's been political, mm-hmm. right? And I think that we've been doing that for a very long time. But I think it's even more so now because we're all aware of the fact that, you know, as women, our basic personhood is under debate legislatively. You
right.
know, people are, you know, abortion is essentially inaccessible to a lot of women throughout the country. And that's just basic health care. Whatever your views on abortion as a moral issue, that's your deal. But I believe that people have basic control over their own bodies and to make those choices.
Right.
We don't give women that. It's that is hotly debated is really shameful to me and indicative of where we are as a society.
Is the shame and judgment many women experience in pregnancy and motherhood coming from within, or are women internalizing external rhetoric and narratives?
I think it's all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, you align with power. So I think, you know, a lot of women don't want to, I think a lot of the issues in pregnancy, you know, we tend to divide along these lines of like, oh, did you drink wine in your pregnancy, right? Or like after the baby's born, like, are you co-sleeping or mm-hmm. what kind of diapers are you using? You know, none of those things really matter that much, right? And I look at it, I assume good intent. I don't think any of us really want to be judgmental, but I think it's very easy to do that. It's human nature. And it comes from the fact that we don't support women, right? So we don't have things like family leave, right, that allow people the time and space to figure out how to take care of their baby and what their baby responds well to and what works well for their family. And so when you're not supported, you don't always feel confident in your choices. So you kind of compensate and own your choices really strongly. And then it's very easy to be like, oh, they're doing something different. Maybe, oh, is that better? Mm-hmm. Or you start to question. And I think that it turns women into, it's very fraught. You know, like there's some nervousness around putting out a book around motherhood and pregnancy
because
people have a lot of strong feelings about it. And my feeling is do what you want. What's right for you isn't going to be necessarily right for somebody else. But if we all had access to information and we all felt empowered to make our choices with confidence, then we could cut out a lot of that noise.
There's a lot of shame attached to breastfeeding. Why?
Is there?
Take a look at the sort of hashtags that we've seen on Twitter. 2.5 million breastfeeding hashtags, 650,000 normalizing. So certainly there's some pushback on something going on. No?
Yeah, I know. I see what you're saying. I think I was thinking from, you know, women's point of view.
No. Societally, I mm-hmm. think. Yeah,
I mean, I think, again, it's, you know, just as a biological fact, you know, we're mammals. We have mammary glands. And so breasts exist first and foremost to feed our young. You know, it's a marvelous thing that we've evolved. It's a tremendous power that we have. But in our culture, we tend to see breasts as they're sexualized.
Right.
When really, like, it's great that we can enjoy them sexually. I'm glad that we can do that. But really, they serve a biological function first and foremost. So I think that when a breast is exposed, people tend to freak out about it. But really, it's just there. It's like watching someone eat a salad with a fork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is just the way that I'm feeding this small person
mm-hmm.
who needs me.
You just had a second baby you referenced. How did you feel this time around?
I felt I trusted myself a lot more. I mean, what I figured out was that I wrote this book, but there's still so much that I don't know and there's a lot to learn. But I felt more confident in decisions that I was making. Meanwhile, my pregnancy, again, since I was geriatric in my pregnancy, which is the technical term, I felt it more in my body and it was a much more difficult pregnancy. But I enjoyed it just a little bit more.
Right. And you have a chapter called Best Laid Plans. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we encourage people to write birth plans these days. And I had this really wonderful Word document with bullet points that outlined exactly how I wanted my birth to go. And none of that happened. And so I think it's important, you know, birth plans, which a lot of people do these days, can be really useful because it helps you clarify what's important to you. It's also a document that people caring for you might feel obligated to follow, which is great. There's something to, like, hold them accountable to. But as any woman who's gone through, you know, no one comes out of childbirth unscathed in some way, even if you have something, a labor and delivery that's really smooth. And it is inherently unpredictable and you can't control it. And that's something that I learned. And
I still have my wife's birth plan saved on my desktop and it cracks me up every time I look at it still because it resembles nothing of what actually happened.
Right. And how did she feel about that? Was that hard for her to... reconcile?
In the moment, no. In the moment, it was what it was. She was doing her thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Afterwards, it was just a kind of a good laugh. Like, it's a learning lesson, right?
Yeah.
About sort of that disconnect between best laid plans and what actually happens in reality.
Yeah.
And you wanted very much to have a vaginal birth, yes?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I mean, I thought, I just believed, you know, this is what my body was meant to do. Women have been doing this for centuries. So the idea of joining that tradition and accessing that power was very exciting to me.
Yeah.
But that's not how either of my births turned out. And now I'm grateful, you know, and it's really changed my own view, which is that we give birth two ways now, you mm-hmm. know, and one is not more natural than the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one was the first way. And I think, you know, recovery time after a vaginal birth is generally, it's generally easier than having major abdominal surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at this point, people have different preferences. And where we are at now, we're holding on to this idea that one is natural, one is not, one is better, and one is not, and that's just not true anymore.
It's a fantastic book, one to add to the canon or to change the canon. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, DW.
I've been speaking with Angela Garbus about her new book, Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy, published by Harper Wave. Angela Garbus will be in conversation with Emily Gould on Monday, June 4th at Greenlight Bookstore at 7:30 p.m. That's in Fort Greene, 686 Fulton Street.